It's time for Security Now. Oh, man, is there a lot to talk about. Steve Gibson is here. We'll, of course, talk about Audi and VW. And, well, we're going to talk about ad blockers and iOS. There's a great show ahead. Stay tuned. Security Now is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 526, recorded Tuesday, September 22nd, 2015. iOS content blockers. Security Now is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK. With one simple integration, you get every way to pay. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/securitynow. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. Save 50% off the monthly price with a 12-month subscription. Go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code SN50 at checkout. And by IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning, and IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30. It's time for Security Now, the show that protects you and your loved ones online. Privacy and all that. Steve Gibson is here. He is the man behind GRC.com, SpinRite, the world's best hard drive utility, and, of course, an expert on all this stuff because it started by him having to deal with spyware and DDoSes and bad guys. And now I think it's got to be, Steve, something you actually are very interested in and love doing.
Oh, well, you know, can you say squirrel?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like this is, you know, it's essentially I got into it because it was a new technology where everything was available. What I really like is, well, very much sort of the whole open approach. With the net, we had RFCs that laid out how all of this worked. So I was able to just sit down and read through it and figure it out and then begin to play with it. So I got sucked into it because it was inherently a non-proprietary technology that anyone who was interested could just, you know, learn about as much as they wanted to. And then it was things like the logic of the software firewall, the idea of finding something in my computer, the adware that I hadn't installed, and I was like, whoa, wait a minute now, then wanting to monitor that and so forth. So yeah, it's just I think the whole security thing. I mean, we really started now more than 10 years ago before it became the huge issue that it is. We knew it was, you know, I mean, you suggested this because you knew that was sort of my focus, not that it was going to be like this crazy hot button issue where, well, for example, one of the things we're going to talk about is India's trial balloon they have floated up on their national government-backed encryption policy, which is just, oh boy, well, we'll have to see how it goes. But we're going to talk, of course, about iOS's Xcode ghost problem, the critical Adobe Flash update, AVG's privacy policy update, and calling it a privacy policy at this point is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. The Cisco router problem where malicious firmware has been discovered by, I think it was the guys at FireEye, the Ashley Madison password mistake that was discovered. We have to talk, just because we've been dealing with vehicle security stuff, briefly about the VW Audi catastrophe where they got caught, cheating. A little update on stage fright. And I've taken a look at a collection of the current ad block offerings, all the ones that appeared immediately and have have sort of a feature comparison and some recommendations
for iOS specifically.
Not for iOS. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Specifically for iOS. So I think a great and interesting podcast.
Can't
once
wait.
Again.
I'm excited. In fact, I'm really interested in your recommendation for iOS ad blocker. I've been so happy with uBlock Origin. We still think that's probably the best.
Yep.
Well, there's many good choices on the desktop.
Right. And in fact, the simplest and easiest to use choice for iOS is by Chris, who is maintaining the non-Origin version of uBlock. So he's the guy that is keeping uBlock going at uBlock.org, and he produced Purify, which is his iOS blocker. And I like it because I think it's very clear that what we're going to see, and in fact, you guys were already talking about it on MacBreak Weekly, and we predicted this on our podcast, is sites that start becoming increasingly sensitive to their visitors' use of ad blockers. Mm-hmm. And some may say, hey, you know, I noticed you have an ad blocker running. Would you consider disabling it? So because, you know, we depend upon your seeing ads in order to support the site. Others might deny you access until you lower your shields.
And I think that's a big mistake, frankly.
As was said on MacBreak Weekly, many people sort of flip their finger and go to somewhere else. And one of the things I want to talk about was Dave Weiner did an interesting post ad block blog. We mentioned him briefly a couple weeks ago because he was feeling that suddenly his Mac OS was becoming unusefully social. He was the one who talked about, you know, your baseball bat reminding you that your mortgage payment was due. And he said, who asked for this? Anyway, so he had some little pithy comments that I want to share. But what was interesting was reading that and having thought about all this brought me to a question I have seen nobody ask anywhere. So we're going to ask a question that I think it'll be something you pick up on, Leo, and that you'll be, you know, asking your own co-hosts in future podcasts, because it's an interesting issue that no one has touched on before. So yes, a great podcast.
Well, as usual, all of this and more in just a moment. But first, we have to do an ad. Turn your ad blocker off. Actually, this is an ad. If you're a mobile developer, you want to hear. This is all about Braintree Payments. And we've been talking a lot, of course, about the ability to do mobile payments. Apple Pay has really brought that to the forefront. Android Pay just came out last week. There's, of course, PayPal, credit cards. But there's things like Bitcoin and Venmo. Wouldn't you like to have every payment solution in your mobile app? Do you want to code that yourself? Do you really want to code that for yourself? No. What you want is somebody who's an expert in this, who's made it easy, who's made it secure, very important, and made it something that your customers will adore. And that's why we love Braintree. In fact, you've used Braintree. You just maybe don't know it. Braintree is the payment solution behind Uber and Airbnb and a lot of other well-known websites, including GitHub. If you're a programmer, I'm pretty sure you've used GitHub. The new buyable pins feature on Pinterest, have you played with that yet? The ability to just buy something without leaving Pinterest? That's the Braintree One Touch SDK, which is so cool. In fact, really, that's what's the great thing about Braintree, and if you've used Uber, you realize that's kind of almost the secret sauce behind Uber, is the fact that you don't have to even think about it. You just get out of the car, and it's paid. That's Braintree. One Touch V.0 works for iOS, Android, JavaScript, a great SDK, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby, 10 lines of code, excellent documentation, and very nice code, which, by the way, you can look at braintreepayments.com/security now. They even have a sandbox, so you can actually play with it a little bit. It speaks 6 languages. It works in 130 currencies, 40 plus countries, fraud protection, fast payouts, great live customer support. I mean, I can go on and on, but why don't you just try it? BraintreePayments.com/security now. BraintreePayments.com/security now. You need a little more incentive? All right, how about your first $50,000 in transactions fee free? BraintreePayments.com/security now. You're going to love it. Back to Steve and the security news.
Yo, Leo. So the picture of the week, I just stuck in here. I wanted to check the connectivity before we started the podcast. And I got a big kick out of seeing that when I went to speedtest.net, the introduction page had the standard little speed test gizmo in the center. It was surrounded by what I chose as my ad filler for Google contributor.
Little bubbles or whatever.
Yeah, they're sort of pastel. Yeah. And actually, they're mouse sensitive. If you mouse over them, they sort of rearrange themselves. And I'm just bringing up the itemization, and I thought I would just see what speed test showed. Speedtest.net, 61 cents of my money has gone to support them.
This is Google Contributor, which...
This is Google Contributor.
If you're using an ad blocker, you really ought to consider something like this as well.
Yeah, I think it's just the, you know, I give them as much money as they will take per month, which is $10, and they spread it around based on my surfing. And now when I look at the sites I've contributed to, because there's a complete enumeration of them from most money to least, I mean, I'm scrolling down through like everywhere I go. It's just like crazy. So
I'm sure Adblockalypse has pushed more people in this direction, too. They're trying to figure out some solution to the widespread use of ad blockers.
Well, and we're just going through, as we've said on this podcast for the last month or so, every week, a transitional phase. It'll be really interesting to see how it all shakes out.
Hey, can I recommend a better speed test, though?
Yeah.
Because speedtest.net is notorious for being... you know what Volkswagen did with the diesel engine?
Yes, special casing. This is the problem. Actually, any popular speed test suffers from this possibility, and that is that that your ISP will give specific IPs that are known to be associated with the speed testing servers preferential performance. So the good news is, I haven't mentioned this on the podcast, but now when I upload the edited audio for Elaine, I trigger GRC's DOS attack alarms because my connection is so fast to GRC that this huge blob of data comes in and the server says, "Help, this, we're under attack." It's like, "No, this is just a big file that I'm sending."
Now that's a good speed test. Too many packets.
So which one do you
like? I use the one at DSL Reports. You know them, of course. They've been on for ages.
Of course.
They have a very elegant one that doesn't use Java or Flash, which this one does. Speed test does. And it's done in JavaScript, and it's really, I think, very nice. Gives you buffer bloat information. I don't know how accurate that part is, but I find it to be a I think you'll like, when you see it, it's a geek's version of speed test. I think you'll like it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
DSLReports.com. It's the second, you know, just click the speed test.
And they've got a bunch of good utilities.
They're good, but they're not immune to this thing that ISPs do.
Same problem. The only way to really know is to transfer a big file from somewhere where you know the sending end is not bandwidth constrained.
Right.
You know, for example, if there was a something that was being served by a CDN, you know, a big hefty content delivery network, you can presume that it's going to be able to deliver it. The problem is many of those are deliberately throttled because, for example, they offer video and they don't want to just give you this massive video file all at once because you may only watch the first few minutes and then go, okay, this is not, you know, and then you switch away. So it behooves them them to send it to deliberately throttle that so that you're only staying ahead of where you need to be rather than giving it all to you. So the bottom line is it's not an easy problem to solve. I had an idea years ago for a GRC utility that would do this. The problem is it wouldn't work well in a shared sort of a packet limited cable modem style mode, but it was sort of clever. It used bouncing off of the nearest router and didn't actually require you to transfer data from some third party location. It was able to check the speed of the so-called last mile link, the final link between your ISP and you. So I may, once squirrels
behind. Oh, I hear that phrase. I may, not good.
I'm not being distracted.
I may. No.
Okay. So, iOS and iTunes and the Apple App Store got hit. What was interesting was the way this was discovered that I haven't heard anyone talk about, and that is that there was a sort of a modest developer whose handle is RealPG, and they were just experimenting with an app, a very simple iOS app that had no internet functionality, didn't use the iCloud APIs, and was just sort of like a little starter app for iOS, using, of course, the Xcode toolkit, which is sort of the whole tool chain that Apple makes available for developing apps. And as you guys mentioned on Mac Break Weekly, or as Renee was able to fill in the details, the problem in China is that obtaining those libraries from Apple, for whatever reason, is really slow. And I have seen that said many times. So many Chinese developers get them from a local server. And in fact, in this case, it was Baidu that is has a good reputation. They're a major Chinese internet company, and so they were offering the Xcode toolchain. Now, Apple has measures to detect tampering, and the developer would have had to have those. All the developers would have had to turn that off in order to not to be notified that there was a problem. But I'm not deep enough into this to know whether there's, like, if there would have been other reasons to turn that off, like maybe there are other restrictions that creates. But what this guy, this RealPG a Chinese developer, found was that although their code had no iCloud APIs and was not doing anything on the internet, their code was popping up a dialogue asking for the iCloud password. And so they said, wait, we don't want that. Who's asking for that? And then they used an iPhone that they use for development, which allowed them to verify connectivity, and they found that there was a conversation with a remote command and control server happening with when their program was being run. So that immediately told them that something fishy was here. Now we know that I saw a number of as high as 300 apps, Chinese apps, got into the App Store. Palo Alto Networks here in the States identified 39 different infected apps, among them was WeChat, which is super popular. So you do have to wonder how a high profile, high end app like WeChat could have been compiled with sort of secondhand tools, but I guess that's just, no one was presuming that the Apple toolchain could have a problem, although it also required disabling this notification that would have let people know that there was something fraudulent about the tool chain. So anyway, all of the apps that were affected have been removed. And of course, the problem now is that the word may not have gotten, you know, these were, some of them were apps specifically planted to be downloaded and to be, you know, to be sort of like phishing apps. WeChat would, of course, immediately fix their problem and push out an update and update all their users. There are many of these others that, you know, don't want to update anybody. They want the people to continue using this bogus app because it does have remote access capabilities. It's able to fish for user credentials. It's able to hook URL schemes. The scheme is the thing like the HTTPS. It turns out that the iPhone is full of these schemes. iOS uses these schemes for all kind of inter-app hooks. And so this thing would be re-registering schemes for itself, essentially taking them away from apps that used to have them as a means of inserting itself into the control chain fraudulently. And it's also able to read and write data to the user's clipboard, which can be very dangerous because the clipboard is a protected resource in iOS that you know, where users have to deliberately copy and paste to and from it. This allows the app to have access to it because it's got special privileges thanks to being part of the developer tool chain. And of course, people often use the clipboard to copy a password from a password manager and then paste it, you know, into the web app or some other app that they're using. So the clipboard can often have sensitive information. So anyway, this was a big breach I wouldn't call this Apple's fault, except maybe they need, and I wouldn't be surprised if they react to this by somehow making it more difficult to be developing apps with a fraudulent tool chain. At least they were able to find them and quickly expunge them from the store.
That'd be easy to do. Just put a hash out, right?
You would think so. And it may be as simple as what they're doing. I don't know the ins and outs of app development. So I don't want to, you know, guess, but still, I wouldn't be surprised if Apple, you know, Apple generally responds to this kind of thing. And this was a big black eye, so they want to get that fixed. I want to also mention, while we're talking about iOS, that there were so many security improvements in iOS 9 that I can't even summarize them. In fact, I started counting them, and I thought, okay, well, this is dumb. I mean, it's just across the board. WebKit had CVSs, just be innumerable CVSs. So we should not, the Security Now message here is don't think of this only as offering some features that you may or may not feel like you want. For example, there's a new OpenSSL carried by iOS 9, which you definitely want because OpenSSL has been subject to a bunch of problems. And so you know, certainly Apple sends out security updates from time to time. This iOS 9 had a boatload of, like, across the board, I mean, a breathtaking number of them. For anyone who's interested, I do have the link to the enumeration of them. If you want to kind of chuckle, Leo, you can bring up, it's on that second page here, the iOS 9 support.apple.com, and then a URL. But I mean, it just goes, as you scroll, it just goes on and on and on and on. And many of them have like multiple CVS numbers. The WebKit ones especially are just like, you know, line after line after line of these. So lots got fixed in iOS 9, definitely more than just a, you know, oh, here's some new features to support new stuff.
You know, this is kind of interesting. They give credit if there's a bug report to the people who discovered it.
Yeah.
Like, here's a guy from the Yahoo pen test team and somebody from SafeEye and Greyhash. That's kind of interesting. I guess that's probably a badge of honor if you get your...
Yeah, and look where your scroll time is. You're
I'm
about
only on I. It goes on for quite a while. Wow. But this is a major upgrade, and in fact, this is specifically a bug fix upgrade. So,
yes, yes, and of course, we got all of the new features in iOS right. 9 as well.
Does but, show you that Apple kind of stores up fixes.
Well, and I think there are some which, for just because they are so deep in the system, there were a bunch of core networking. Fixes I noticed. So there may be some that just don't lend themselves to incremental changes where, you know, they had to like make some core plumbing fixes. We've talked about that in the past where they would do a quick fix to solve the problem, but the real fix is going to take a lot longer. And so, you know, just like involve, you know, rewriting some fundamental function which they couldn't break in an update, but they had to quickly patch it so that it wouldn't be exploitable. Yet, you know, they really had to take their time and think something through more deeply. So this really has that sort of feeling to it. Like, you know, this was a major set of like next, you know, step forward. We did get, speaking of major, although I wouldn't call this a step forward, anything to deal with Adobe Flash is a step backwards. But there was a major critical update. The good news is, of course, Chrome and IE are both managing Flash now on their own. Firefox, you know, still sort of waits for the user to give it a nudge. So for Firefox users, you need to go to Tools, Add-ons, and then the Plugins tab under Add-ons. And there's a sort of a little obscure link at the top. I wish they'd made this a bigger button, but it's just a little text link, and you wouldn't know it was a link, except that it's blue, that says, check to see if your plugins are up to date. So you click that, and wham, you'll get a big red, you know, finally, whoa, Flash is bad, get a new one. And then you have to, of course, restart Firefox. Maybe the problem is that I don't restart Firefox on a daily basis. I just, it's like, it's the first thing I run when my OS starts and the last thing I shut down when I'm
same
shutting
thing with
down.
Chrome. And I never, you know, I may not restart Chrome for days.
Yeah. Although I do know that Google is updating all the time. I see like five processes running in my process list. So that, you know, even if I'm not using Chrome, there are little gremlins at least in Windows that are running around keeping things updated for the next time that I do run Chrome. So you want to be at version 19.00185. I was at 18 point something. So now we're at 19.0.0.185. And in case of Firefox, you may need to give yourself a nudge. And they fixed nearly two dozen vulnerabilities. And this is important because, as we'll see, one of the mentions that when we get into talking about content blocking, that just today was a blog entry about Forbes, the Forbes.com site serving malware for about a week. And it was exploiting a collection of seven different Adobe vulnerabilities, Flash vulnerabilities in one ad. That just like if there was anything that you had missed, this thing would burrow into your system just by you know visiting Forbes.com. So
I mean everybody goes there.
Yeah. So. It was. I did also want to mention to remind people that while you're in Firefox, if you're a Firefox user, when you're at the plugins page, or I'm sorry, I think it's at the at the add-ons plugins page on the far right is the ask to activate. You definitely want to do that. So, for example, Leo, you were mentioning that speedtest.net is a Flash app, and sure enough, you know when I go there on Firefox, I get up, it's just sort of a gray rectangle, and it shows a weird little Lego block that's you know, and it says, you know, click here to activate. And when I do, then I get over by the URL, I get a pop-up from Firefox that says, it confirms I want to allow, and then I can choose to allow and remember if I want to whitelist this site's use of Flash. Anyway, so lots of protection, but... And we've talked about this in Chrome. Chrome is defaulting now, not for first-party Flash content, but so, for example, you know, if you were on YouTube and for whatever reason you couldn't use the HTML5 player and it did a fallback, then it would still play because that would be coming from presumably first-party content. But ads coming from a third party, those are now click to run. So probably something is shown if it doesn't run, but at least you're not running the active content, which is what enables the exploit. So, you know, we're finally beginning to see by default these constant year after year vulnerabilities being fixed proactively by the way that they're being used in the system by the technology that, you know, non-listeners to the podcast, most people just, you know, use their browser and go to sites, and they're not, you know, as I've often called it, the tyranny of the default. They're not tuning and tweaking anything. They're just hoping to surf the net and not get hurt. Okay, now, this was chilling. There was a lot of controversy generated by this. AVG, the number three most popular antivirus tool that offers a free version, which many people use. Number one most popular is Microsoft. Number two is Avast. And number three is AVG. They've changed their privacy policy, notified their users that a new policy becomes effective as of October 15th. So about 3 weeks from now, really raising hackles within the privacy community, because the new policy states that users of the AVG antivirus will be permitting AVG to sell search and browser history data to third-party advertisers in order to make money from its antivirus software. Now, the problem is that AV software inherently runs in our system with elevated privileges so that it's able to detect and block malware, adware, spyware, and other threats. And AVG is one of the AV suites, which we've discussed in the past, that installs its own root certificate into users' machines, like Superfish was caught doing, specifically to allow it to intercept, decrypt, and inspect all web browser traffic. So you know, we're not saying anything nefarious is going on, but essentially what they've decided is that they too are sort of going down this path of monetizing the habits of their users. Now, what's really confusing is that an AVG spokesman explained that, quote, any non-personal data collected and sold to advertisers would be cleaned and anonymized, making it impossible to link it back to individual users. And then the spokesman said many companies do this type of collection every day and do not tell their users. So they're trying to claim some cred for, like, being right up front with the fact that they're going to start monetizing by selling their users' search and browser history data. Well, the problem is it's only valuable to advertisers if there's some way to tie it to users. So while AVG may be, you know, sanitizing it in some way, it must be that things like the cookies of the queries, which may not contain, overtly user identify, user identity data, is the token that the advertiser has previously assigned to this person in order to associate them, meaning that, you know, selling data that couldn't be tied back to the user wouldn't generate any revenue. So it's got to be that essentially when you're using AVG in the future, essentially they're now tracking you and saying that they're going to monetize this and sell this to advertisers, which just creates another pipeline for this kind of information. You know, browsing and search history is what they're talking about, to this sort of this unseen advertising tracking database facility. So I just wanted to make sure that our users who may be using AVG were aware that this was something that was going to be happening starting the beginning of next month. Okay, Cisco. Guys at FireEye discovered in a handful of browsers, I think like 14 or 15, located in four different countries. And these are, when I say Cisco, people can sort of now think of Linksys because, you know, they bought Linksys. But no, these are like big iron, you know, Cisco green. Green is the color of Cisco browsers, always has been. That's the color that they chose, sort of a nice forest green. And you can walk into a data center and immediately spot Cisco network equipment because it's Cisco green color. And there were three different model numbers of affected browsers, where they found this stuff. Because they're the big iron style routers. So these are typically positioned on major networks' borders. They're the so-called border routers, which are used as the first line of contact between the internet and the internal intranet that links the network to the internet. What they found was they called it sinful knock malware, SYNFUL, and they called it knocking because the way this works is very clever. We've talked about port knocking of various sorts in the past. The idea is with port knocking, you can have a router like we all have NAT routers now on our borders. You could have a router which silently drops any unsolicited incoming traffic. That's a beautiful firewall-ish nature of any NAT router, is that when someone is trying to, you know, ping you or probe you or scan you or whatever, and this thing comes from a source IP and port that the router didn't first see traffic leaving your network bound for, so that the return traffic is expected. If it's just coming from something that the router's never seen before, it ignores it. Well, it's possible for the router to log that or to make some note of it. And then the idea is that some remote IP, which would normally be blocked exactly in that fashion, could deliberately send packets in a specific sequence to a specific set of ports. That's called a knock. That is, you know, like knocking on the door. You don't get in, but you knock. And if the router is monitoring that and sees a specific set of packets arriving in a certain order on specific ports, that's sort of it's a weak form of access. Weak because, of course, an outside observer could see the knocking, learn the knock sequence, and then themselves gain entry. So it's not super secure, but it's an interesting kind of cool technology to sort of a side effect of what the a border router is doing. These guys found that the Cisco firmware itself, Cisco has their own operating system called iOS, Internet Operating System, which had been modified to look at the TCP sequence numbers. Remember that the SYN packet contains a 32-bit sequence number, which numbers the data that the TCP connection will subsequently be sending. So the SYN packets contain essentially, pieces of information which are normally unpredictable and hopefully random. There's been a history of attacks when that was not the case, and we've talked about that in years past. Pretty much all of the TCP IP stacks have that fixed now, but this can be used for knocking also. So the firmware would be looking for specific sequence number of incoming SYN packets, and when they qualified, SYN and ACK. Normally, I'm trying to think. I think the acknowledgement field on a SYN packet is just null on the on a SYN. Then on a SYN ACK that is the TCP packet sent in response, the sender's own sequence number is in the SYN, the 32-bit SYN field, and the acknowledgement field contains, I think it's the SYN that was received. That would make sense, because then that's going to be advancing as essentially the acknowledgement field is the most recent, the sequence number of the most recent packet received from the sender. So the acknowledgement field says, okay, I've seen with no gaps missing, nothing out of order up to this numbered byte starting with the byte that we began. So these SYN packets came in with both of these fields. So essentially 64 bits of specific information. If they matched a pattern of some sort, then that would identify the IP of the sender as authenticated, and essentially give them access to a command and control that was built into this firmware. So this is really bad. This is it was found in Ukraine, in the Philippines, in Mexico, and India. FireEye did not tell us which companies or networks these were associated with. They kept that quiet. Cisco's been notified. They've put out made a fix available for this. And again, this is not, it didn't, as far as we know, it didn't leverage a Cisco bug, but it did get into the routers. The term, the NSA term that we learned when we talked about some of the early Snowden revelations, were implants. So the presumption is someone had brief physical access. There was some mention made in the FireEye disclosure that the routers use default passwords. So it may have been that someone accessed this as it was being shipped to its destination. We believe this is some of what the NSA is able to do, implanted these changes in the firmware. Then the router was shipped onto its destination. Then the router was configured and set up, but the firmware was just left alone. All the people had to do was re-update there's a ROM-based loader, sort of the pre-iOS loader, RomMon, it's called, the ROM monitor. That's where this stuff was located. So just re-flashing the iOS, which I've done on my Cisco routers through the years, wouldn't have removed this. This is down at a deeper level. So it required, sort of high-level access to this, and it was then deeply implanted and very sticky. This is what's known to be going on, and FireEye found some instances of this out in the wild. Ashley Madison, it was believed that the use of very good bcrypt, bcrypt is one of the so-called PBKDFs, password-based key derivation functions. The idea being that this is the use of these as the state of the art for protecting passwords on a server. The idea being it's no longer enough just to hash the data, even with a per user salt, and then use a good SHA-256 salt. The problem is using a strong GPU or now purpose-specific ASIC hardware, application-specific integrated circuits. Hashing is so fast now, really driven by the Bitcoin mining phenomenon, that what you need is to do iterative hashing. So not just hash, but hash many times. Bcrypt is an algorithm we've discussed which does this. And in fact, Ashley Madison was using a strength of that required 4,096 iterations of within the bcrypt algorithm. So the presumption was of the 36 million passwords in the records that were obtained in the breach, it would take a long time, basically be infeasible to crack them. And there was some early success only because the passwords were so bad. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And given the nature of the Ashley Madison site, one's imagination could lead you to some creative guessing, which turned out to be accurate in many instances. So the hackers were having fun guessing what people might have used as their Ashley Madison passwords. And what do you know? That happened to succeed for many accounts. Completely separate from that, what was discovered among the data was that of the 36 million accounts, 15.25 million had some additional data associated with it. It had an MD5 hash, and no one's really sure why. My theory is that this was old technology, that the very, very first instance of the web software that ran Ashley Madison in the beginning used a simple MD5 hash. I mean, even then they were doing some hashing, which is better than many high-profile sites that didn't even bother with that. But it wasn't very good. And in fact, it looks – the reason I believe this is that they were lowercasing the username and lowercasing the password. They were then concatenating them with a pair of colons and taking the MD5, the standard MD5 hash of that. Well, that would be a reasonable hash to use for verifying login, like for your beta of the site as you're getting going. And I say that because then they fixed it a little bit later, not very well. They added the email address and a supposedly secret bunch of gibberish. It's sort of like unchanging salt. It was the digit 7 and then 3, an at sign, I'm blanking on the name of that thing. Not a tilde, the little hat symbol. It's the shift 6.
A circumflex.
Circumflex, yes. I actually had the word, but it somehow didn't feel like it was a circumflex. Okay. The raise to the power of symbol in many languages.
Yes.
And then lowercase bhhs ampersand, pound sign, at, ampersand, circumflex, at, eight, at, asterisk, dollar sign, double quotes. Or I guess that the double quotes is the end of my quoted string. So it's like, okay, so that's some salt that they added. But so the point is that the username is part of all of these MD5, is part of the hashing. And the username is available in the breached data. So that removes it. Then all we're left with in the first case is lowercasing the password. So, of course, that discards any case sensitivity from guessing. So the guessers only need to use lowercase guesses. The person's email address is also part of the observed data. The bottom line is that as a consequence of this probably obsolete, that is, only what, less than half of the accounts had this. My guess is this was used early on and then it was replaced by the really good 4096 iteration bcrypt pbk df function, but they left the original data there. Because, of course, you'd have to have some crossover. You need to allow your users to log in using their original username and password. So you'd still have to have the weak username and password authentication in place while you then generated the new, stronger one. But if we know anything, we know that these guys weren't doing a very good job. For example, people were able to pay to be removed from the database, and we now know from the retrieval that they were never removed. Yeah. So neither were neither removed was what looks like the early versions of their username and password authentication. As a consequence of the fact that stayed around, it turned out to be vastly simpler to guess people's passwords. For 15.26, that is the 15 and a quarter million accounts that also had these weak MD5 hashes, 11 million have now been cracked. And of course, the problem is we now have username, we've got email address, and their password. So anyone who reused a password from some other site is in more trouble, because we know their name, we have their email address, and if they were among the early adopters of these of Ashley Madison, it's probable in at least 11 million cases their password has now been cracked, because the MD5 token makes it easy to perform a brute force password guess, especially when you're throwing away case. That then allows them to then they verify that against the bcrypt verified password to essentially crack the user's data completely. And if you did reuse your passwords, then you're in trouble. So, yikes!
Yikes!
Yeah, the breach that just keeps on giving. Okay, so this is not about security, but we've talked about the technology that is entering the automotive sphere, and apparently this affects just shy of 500,000 VWs and Audis. It's the Jetta models year 2009 to 2022 now. The Beetles from year 2009 on, the Audi A3 from 2009, the Golf from 2009 on, and the Passat only 2014 and from now on. This was from the EPA.gov site. They said the EPA is issuing a notice of violation, an NOV, of the Clean Air Act to Volkswagen AG, Audi AG, and Volkswagen Group of America, Inc., collectively referred to as Volkswagen. The NOV, this notice of violation, alleges that four-cylinder Volkswagen and Audi diesel cars from model years 2009 through 2015 include software that circumvents EPA emissions standards for certain air pollutants. California is separately issuing an in-use compliance letter to Volkswagen and EPA, and the California Air Resources Board have both initiated investigations based on Volkswagen's alleged actions. As described in this notice of violation, a sophisticated software algorithm on certain Volkswagen vehicles detects when the car is undergoing official emissions testing and turns full emissions controls on only during the test. The effectiveness of these vehicles' pollution emissions control devices, they write, is greatly reduced during all normal driving situations. This results in cars that meet emissions standards in the laboratory or testing station, but during normal operations emit nitrogen oxides, or NOx, at up to 40 times the standard. The software produced by Volkswagen is a, quote, defeat device, unquote, as defined by the Clean Water Act. And then in some, there were some interesting commentary that I appreciated that provided a little bit more details. This writer posted, just when the promise of diesel was gaining new legs thanks to lower diesel fuel prices, new low-carbon fuels and engines that could easily meet the strictest emission standards in the world, the EPA issued a notice of violation letter to the largest seller of diesel engines in the U.S. and the largest auto manufacturer in the world. During dynamometer testing for both emissions and fuel economy certification, 2.0-liter VW TDIs, and I didn't have a chance to look up that acronym. Do you know what that means?
It seemed because I have an Audi, but I don't have a TDI engine.
Oh, so okay, so it's a type of
it's their diesel. It's probably a marketing term, but I'll look it up.
Yeah,
real quick. Yeah.
VW TDIs from 2009 through 2015 worked in a
turbocharged direct injection.
Ah, nice. nice high end, you know,
it's
diesel.
Turbo diesel. Although these were only four cylinders that they detected it in. So.
Right, two liter. So that's the smaller of the lineup, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Worked in a dyno mode tune that performed satisfactorily and easily met the legal limits for a variety of pollutants, including NOx. So this guy said, unfortunately, when the ECU detected that the car was not on a dynamometer, and this writer says, I'm still not entirely clear as to how this was accomplished. And that would be a juicy little tidbit. The emissions controls were allowed to relax, providing both the power and efficiency turbo diesel injected. Turbo diesel injected TDI owners have come to rely on. This in turn allowed between 10 and 40 times the legal limit of NOx to be emitted while driven in the manner that we all drive. In an EPA teleconference call with the media, Cynthia Giles, an enforcement officer at the EPA, stated, quote, put simply, these cars contain software that turns off emissions controls when driving normally and turns them on when the car is undergoing an emissions test. And then this guy had a little more information saying the defeat device, as it was called, or dyno mode programming within the Bosch EDC-17 ECU has been a part of OEM testing for decades. It was the relaxing of the emissions control system's code that caused the real problems.
Eric Duckman suggests that the way you would tell if it's on a dynamometer is if it's going road speed, RPMs, but nobody's touching the steering wheel. There's no movement of the steering wheel.
Interesting.
Yeah, that would be one way for sure. Or no weight in the seat.
Right?
Because, all of these cars have weight in the seat sensors for a seatbelt.
Right.
There's probably a number of ways to do it. I mean, it's such an abnormal, you know, you get all these high RPMs, but nobody's in the vehicle. That would probably be a giveaway.
Yeah, that might. And I wouldn't be. Also, don't they? I guess it's. No. I was going to say they're also not level normally, but I think they are level.
Yeah,
they merely put the back wheels on those two rollers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's
a
DMCA angle on this because the DMCA forbids reverse engineering software in these vehicles. Had that been, and a lot of researchers would have liked to have gotten in there. Had that been legal, we might have seen this along. You know, we might have noticed this years ago.
Yeah.
But it's not legal.
So,
to
what do you think this means? You think this means that the cars cannot deliver the power that they're selling?
Exactly.
And also meet the strict California emissions standards.
Exactly. That's exactly right. What people don't like about diesel is the hesitation. Diesel has a lot of torque at startup, but they don't like the hesitation. I bet you anything it has to do with just trying to get the performance. You know, that was what they were selling these diesels with. These new diesel engines, they perform like gasoline engines. They're efficient, small. Not a lot of incentive to buy them here. Diesel fuel is more expensive than gasoline in California. But I wasn't tempted. I have an Audi. It's shameful.
Yeah,
I won't buy another Audi.
Get caught. Okay, get this now. Oh boy, this is the short version. Is how to do it all wrong. This is India's. I'm not kidding you. There's a PDF link in the show notes to the whole draft. I've excerpted a few tasty bits, but I've mostly summarized this. This is India's draft national encryption policy. So we've talked about how we're living in interesting times. You know, years ago famously suspended work on CryptoLink because I was worried about what was going to happen. And we've got now, you know, Apple fighting with the DOJ because DOJ wants iMessages to be turned over. Microsoft fighting because the DOJ or law enforcement wants email that's being stored in servers in Ireland and so forth. So India has produced a request, you know, a four comments draft policy. Publicintelligence.net summarized it, saying the following draft copy of the National Encryption Policy was released for public comment by the India Department of Electronics and Information Technology. The policy has been widely criticized for requiring businesses, internet service providers, and even private citizens to store decrypted versions of encrypted communications for 90 days to provide to the government and law enforcement, and I'm adding, if required. So that's sort of that's the crux of this, is that their solution to the problem, such as it is, or that is the solution, is to say, okay, one way or another, encryption must be made available in plain text form for 90 days from the time it was created, transmitted, stored, whatever. So first of all, this applies to both data in motion, in transit, or at rest. And, you know, it starts off with your standard, you know, the recognition of the need to protect privacy and increase the security of the internet and associated information systems have resulted in the development of policies that favor the spread of encryption worldwide. Yeah, right. The Information Technology Act 2000. So apparently there's some existing boilerplate that they've got from 15 years ago. Information Technology Act 2000 provides for prescribing modes or methods of encryption in its section 84A and decryption, that's good, in section 69. Taking into account the need to protect information assets, international trends, and concerns of national security, the cryptographic policy for domestic use supports the broad use of cryptography in ways that facilitates individual and business privacy, international economic competitiveness in all sectors, including government. This policy is not applicable to sensitive departments / agencies of the government. So they're making an exception for themselves and national security. So it's like, this is what we're going to impose on businesses and individuals, but not on the government, which performs sensitive and strategic roles. This policy is applicable to all central and state government departments, including sensitive departments and agencies, while performing non-strategic and non-operational roles. All statutory organizations, executive bodies, business and commercial establishments, including public sector undertakings and academic institutions, and all citizens, including personnel of government, business performing non-official personnel functions. So just to summarize, they said under objectives, the first and main objective, to synchronize with the emerging global digital economy, network society, and use of encryption for ensuring security and confidentiality of data, and to protect privacy in information and communication infrastructure without unduly affecting public safety and national security. So basically, now I'll just summarize, what they are imposing is full regulation of all use of encryption within India's borders. The government will dictate under this the allowable encryption algorithms and key lengths, it says. As I mentioned, both data in transit, so communications links, they did accept the web use of HTTPS. So that they're not targeting. It did say TLS and SSL for internet. So they're not expecting to be able to break that. But for example, iMessage or any encrypted chat, any encrypted conferencing like we're using right now. I mean, basically everything. And they're saying that you can only use approved of algorithms and key lengths. And mostly what the way they're imposing this is to say that upon demand, plain text must be producible for anything encrypted within the past 90 days. The actual verbiage is, on demand, the user shall be able to reproduce the same plain text and encrypted text pairs using the software / hardware used to produce the encrypted text from the given plain text. Such plain text information shall be stored by the user / organization / agency for 90 days from the date of transaction and made available to law enforcement agencies as and when demanded in line with the provisions of the laws of the country. And anyway, so I won't go any further. I had a bunch of more stuff in the notes that anyone is interested. Basically, it's an attempt to fully regulate the encryption problem, to solve the problem by regulating it within India's borders. All vendors of encryption products or service providers offering encryption services shall necessarily register their products and services with government for conducting business in the country.
So they just withdrew it.
What? Oh, no kidding.
About an hour ago.
Okay.
But the real issue, it's so funny, it seems to be that the real, the complaint was about WhatsApp, was about messaging.
Wow, a high-use messaging
right.
app.
Right. Government
essentially.
The government says the rules weren't meant to target WhatsApp, shopping, and other common activities. This is Ravi Shankar, the fabulous sitar player and telecom minister. But I imagine they'll be back with another one. This comes from the Times of India.
Well, so what we saw was what their intent was. But if they're intending to exclude something like WhatsApp, then that would sort of presume. I guess then what is it that they want to get? You know, they obviously they want to be able to get whatever they need.
Right.
But WhatsApp and iMessage would seem to be sort of then within the same domain.
Pavel Durov, the guy who created Telegram, which, as you know, has this sort of security model.
Yeah, sure.
Was asked at TechCrunch Disrupt yesterday, well, it seems to be the case that ISIS is using Telegram.
Oh, no. Is that really true?
And he didn't deny it. Yeah. He said, well, you know, the problem is that people deserve privacy. And you can't and this is Phil Zimmerman always said this about PGP. ISIS uses telephones. You can't eliminate a technology just because a terrorist might use it. And there's an overwhelming need for private communications for normal people as well. So it was an interesting conversation. By the way, currently 60 million active users of Telegram. They just crossed early this year, there were about 1 billion messages a day. He said they're doing 12 billion messages a day. Not a lot more users, just a lot more use.
And half of those, Leo, are because you love it.
That's right. And I love it because of the stickers.
I know. You've got them all.
It has nothing to do with security. I like the stickers.
I think I'm going to catch my breath. Now would be a good time to take a break.
All right. There is still lots to come, lots more to talk about. Yep. And, of course, we're going to get into this whole iOS content filter controversy. There's lots to say about that. And Steve's done some benchmarks, which he's got some opinions about which are the best. That's coming up. First, a word from ProXPN, which would probably be banned in India if that new encryption regime were embraced. Folks, privacy, the ability to use the internet without being spied upon is important. It's important when you're in an internet cafe and a bad guy could be sitting over there watching what you're doing. It's important when your internet service provider is keeping track of everything you do. ProXPN will protect your privacy. It's an open VPN server. And thanks to Steve Gibson, they've actually modified how they do business because Steve said, you know, they were logging activity for 2 weeks. I think not completely unreasonably, the idea being, well, if you have a complaint or a problem, we can look at the logs and see what went on. Now they're not logging at all. Zero logging. They're one of the few VPNs that doesn't keep track of your online activity in any way. It's, of course, OpenVPN, or if you can't use OpenVPN, PPTP, although they do have Android and iOS apps that give you OpenVPN on those platforms. There is no IPv6 traffic leakage, no DNS hijacking. It's fully protected and up to date. They're using the latest software, and that's their full-time job, is keeping it up to date. You can protect yourself against Snoopy ISPs and their six strike rules or their throttling and their monitoring. You can protect, you can appear to be in a variety of countries. They've got servers all over the world, including the UK and Asia. More servers online all the time. That means improved speeds, and they're working really hard to add more servers and more servers and more servers. Software, dedicated software for Windows and Mac, giving you advanced controls. I think ProXPN is worth a look at proxpn.com/twit. ProXPN.com/twit. Use the code SN50 and you'll get half off the monthly price when you sign up for a 12-month subscription. That's basically less than $5 a month when you sign up for a year. And that's good for the lifetime of your account. Also, if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So why not just try the premium right now? Go to ProXPN.com/twit. Use the code SN50. ProXPN accepts payment through Visa, PayPal, and Bitcoin. So you're truly anonymous. We thank ProXPN so much for their support and for providing a great service dedicated to the privacy of all of us all over the world. ProXPN.com/twit, offer code SN50. So that was a quick victory over the Indian government. Actually, I don't think that's over. I think we'll see more. But it's interesting.
Well, it's why I brought it up. They were
obviously stung.
We knew that it was like, you know, this is the first formal proposal that we've seen. I don't know how it's going to sort itself out, but I'm glad that this got brought up at Disrupt, yeah. And that the Telegram guy said, yeah, you know, we provide encryption because our users want it. Everyone has a right to not be listened in on, and we're sorry if bad guys use it. You know, you'll need to get a hold of their conversation by, you know, taking over their phone rather than by...
Yeah, there are means. There are ways to do it, right? Yeah. He says, privacy is... Here's the actual quote. This is Pavel Durov. Privacy is ultimately more important than our fear of bad things happening, like terrorism. If you look at ISIS, yes,
right.
There's a war going on in the Middle East. Ultimately, ISIS will find a way to communicate with its cells. And if any means doesn't feel secure to them, they'll just find something else. We shouldn't feel guilty about it. We're still doing the right thing, protecting our users' privacy. Seems right.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's the way it's going to have to shake out. Unfortunately, as we've discussed, no one can see a way of giving law enforcement what we would be willing to give them if we could without sacrificing the integrity of the technology. But you know, but there just doesn't seem to be a way. It's, you know, yes, we could build an extra set of keys into everything, but then it would just, I mean, then we'd have nothing, because, you know, look at how poorly the federal government is a caretaker of the secrets that we've given them. They're just not. So I did want to mention that the stage fright fixes continue to drift out. I get tweets from people whose random Android phone receives an update, and they go and check with the stage fright detectors, and yay, they get all green. In some cases, they're getting that there's only that one remaining one that came out later that's still vulnerable, and just because there's a delay through the pipeline, you know, getting the updates made and fixed and merged into the firmware and then pushed out. But even as late as, like, you know, a day or two ago, I saw somebody just updated their phone or had their phone update and was now stage fright safe.
Yeah, my Android phones are now safe, according to the Zimperium test, which is the one that seems to find that last
bug.
Even the Galaxy Note 5, a Samsung device, that was updated. You know, it's not updated yet, but it's brand new. Maybe it will be soon. The Moto X Pure, which I just got last week, is still not updated. All the Nexuses are, though. They've been very... OnePlus 2 has been for some time. So, it's getting out there.
And I would say that this is, given that it's known now, and we know that blocking the auto-fetch MSM messages creates a barrier to easy exploitation. This gives us a benchmark for the way the various providers are responding, because there isn't a provider that should not respond, and everyone can see now how long it has taken until they've had the stage fright updates. So it's a little bit of a canary at this point, where we can say, hey, look, you know, as you said, Leo, all of yours, with one exception, are now updated. And that one seems to be pretty new. So they just they're probably scrambling around, pushing the rest of them out the door. I did get a tweet from a listener. I just wanted to share it. Simon is his name, Sphere_AU. So maybe he's Australian. Anyway, he said, just got Let's Encrypt working on my web server. And he's had a shout out to thanking someone for the support in the forums for ironing out some little config issue. And then he said ping at SGGRC. Speaking of which, I'm closing in on 50,000 followers in Twitter. So I'm at 49.9 something. So
that's nice.
It'll be fun to be on, be north of 50.
At SGGRC.
SGGRC.
Yeah.
Couple miscellaneous things. I wanted to say, Leo, I listened to you and Megan yesterday on iOS Today. Toward the end of the show, the topic of batteries came up, and you were fabulous.
Oh, was I right? I hope I was.
Absolutely.
I quoted you.
I was holding my breath at everything. Exactly right.
But why does Battery University say other things about it?
The only thing I can think is that there is one danger, and that is that the state-of-the-art lithium-ion cells really get unhappy if you overcharge them.
Yeah, but that no decent device allows that.
That's exactly correct. So you know, they had some advice that you were exactly correct to challenge and criticize them on, which was, you know, don't leave it plugged in overnight. It's like, what? And don't charge it to 100%. What? You know, because, you know, no, everyone is going to do both of those things. And as you said, it used to be that. You know the RC model car chargers where they charge these batteries super fast. They get really hot, but they just want to like recharge them immediately, stick them in the car, and like run them around again. Those are NiCads, and NiCads have an interesting phenomenon, and that is you can charge them super fast. Their voltage peaks and then starts to drop. And so what the fast chargers do is they look for that, they look for a drop, the beginning of a drop in the battery terminal voltage. And the second they see that, they stop. And that allows you to just cram the current back into the battery, bring it right up to a full charge in just a few minutes, and then stick it back in your car and off you go. The whole deal with lithium ion batteries is, as we know, very different. We wish they were fast to charge, but they're not. You need to charge them slowly, and what you do is you very carefully monitor the terminal voltage and just stop when it reaches a known full charge. You have to be very careful with them not to overcharge. All those fires that we've heard about, you know, like, you know, the laptop explodes in the user's lap. Well, they was plugged in and charging, and the charging circuitry didn't cut off. And boy, if you overcharge these, they're not happy. But as you said, Leo, we've solved this problem. It's like this has been solved. So, but you were, again, your advice was.
Well, let's repeat it because people are now wondering what's the advice.
The advice is lithium ion really dislikes deep discharge. I had a buddy who complained. He lives in the Philippines and visits twice a year. I met him at Starbucks and we've become friends. He was saying that, you know, he was annoyed because his phone. Oh, I happened to see that his phone screen had like red on the battery. And I said, John, what is that about? And he says, it's dead. It's almost dead. I got to plug it in. I said, don't you keep it charged? He says, well, I charge it whenever it almost dies. I said, no. And then he tells me that he keeps like burning out his phones and his iPads. And I said, yes, you cannot deep discharge lithium ion. They really want to be kept near charge. So, you know, charging it at work, charging it at home, no, do not deep cycle them. That's the main advice.
Which is funny because you hear that advice, deep cycle them. So the two rules of thumb are there. Well, you need to know that every lithium ion battery has a certain number of charge cycles. That's a fully charged, fully discharged. And the rule of thumb is keep it fully, keep it plugged in, because you can have fractional discharge. It all adds up though. And you don't want to have, you don't want to hit the number of cycles. And then if you're storing it, I think you said keep it at half, right?
Yes, and you're completely correct. Again, it was perfect.
Well, I memorized what you said.
So the one reason that it might make sense to occasionally do a discharge is, and it's referred to as battery conditioning sometime. What that actually is doing is synchronizing the device's awareness of how much right. charge is in the battery.
Right.
So because if you just sort of float the battery around, plugging it in, pulling it out, plugging it in, pulling it out, it's possible for, because the battery itself doesn't provide any indication of how much charge it has. What happens is in a lithium ion, the terminal voltage stays flat for a long time, drooping only very slowly, and then toward the end it falls off. So
that's why it's at 100% sometimes for a long time, and then it starts to go down. That makes
right.
sense.
Right. And so what's happening is a software algorithm is having to guess. It's sort of running a down counter while it sees that you're using power and it's not plugged in. It's kind of going, okay, well, maybe 89, maybe 85. Yeah. I mean, it has no idea.
Right.
So it's just sort of, it's just ad hoc. When you fully charge it, then it can say, okay, we're back at 100. But it still can't quite tell where the bottom is unless you reach it. That is because, as you also properly said, there is a total, like, there's a total amount of use that lithium ion batteries will have. But so an older one will, you know, it'll only hold maybe 3/4 or 2/3 of as much energy. But again, the counter doesn't know unless it watches it go down and run dry. Then it goes, oh, now I'm recalibrated on the current state of health of this battery. So then you charge it fully, and now it knows it's a little bit more pessimistic, but more realistic about how much time is actually left. If anyone is, for example, has had a device suddenly die when it said, wait a minute, you said I had 50% left, and suddenly it's dead. It's like, yes, that's a perfect example of the device not having been able to calibrate itself. So sometimes it is useful to bring it all the way down, but not as your normal daily. I mean, some people don't charge them until they're dead. And it's like, oh, boy, you know. And unfortunately, we don't have replaceable batteries in these devices any longer. So, you know, it's like a problem if you kill it. So 100% advice. I just did want to mention, I heard you talking, I guess it was about Audible, of course, the other day. And I have to tip my hat to Peter Hamilton, who's one of our favorite sci-fi authors. It was the middle of the night. I was doing some reading. I was changing books that I was going to read. I've been studying stress for the last year, actually, and anxiety and how the whole hormonal and brain mechanism systems. There is the reference text for this is by a neuroscientist. The title of the book is Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. It's a dumb title for a fabulous, I mean, deep science book. But I was reading the cortisol connection, and I was switching back to zebras. And I thought, I'll just kind of take a look at The Abyss Beyond Dreams. That's Peter's latest pair of books. He was going to do a trilogy, and he decided just to make it a, what do you call it, two?
Duology?
Duology?
I don't know.
I guess. I just started, like, I'll just kind of see what it's looking like. And I just immediately got sucked in. Now, I didn't lose control. It was late, and I stopped. But I just said, wow, you know, I would be reading it, except that he is not finished. The Night Without Stars is the follow-up to The Abyss Beyond Dreams. And he got me with Pandora's Star, so that I was so annoyed when I finished Pandora's Star, because it was only the first half of the story. And we were all like, oh, what happens now? In fact, I had to reread Pandora's Star when he finally came out with the second half of that story. So I'm not doing it again, Peter. I'm waiting until The Night Without Stars is finished. He's off on some child's fantasy book series. And it's like, come on, come back to hard sci-fi. We need a second of these, because this is the Chronicle of the Fallers is the series that these two books are part of.
So, and I'm putting that Sapolsky book in my Audible cart as we speak.
Is it available on Audible?
Absolutely. Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers.
That's the one, baby. Yep. It is really good. I vouch for that from the science of stress.
Well, really, I got a lot of it, so I'm going to read this.
Listen to it. I think it'll help a lot.
Yeah.
I did get a nice note. This is sort of a different kind of testimonial from a Jim Jerry in League City, Texas. He says, formerly, Mr. Gibson, I have been a loyal customer for a long, all caps, time. How long? I was digging around my closet and found an old Spinrite, A Guide for Owners, version 1.2.
Wow.
And we actually used to publish a hardback book that had a spiral metal spring binding. It was very expensive, but you know, I wanted it to be classy. And he said, and that's what prompted me to write this email. I just wanted to say thank you! Exclamation point. I have used one version of your software on every hard drive I have ever owned, going all the way back to my 10 megabyte hard disk drive on my IBM PC XT. I cannot tell you how many hard drives I've owned over the years, but your software was used to rescue my data time and time again after the drives inevitably quit booting. It was always easier to recover my hard drive with Spinrite than to restore from backups. Your software is as relevant today as it was in the 1980s. Simply amazing. So, wow, Jim, thank you for the shout out for Spinrite.
Can we take one more break and then get to the blockers? All right, we've got about half an hour left. Is that enough to do it?
I've got my eye on it. Yep.
All right. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. We know that many of you are IT professionals and you're looking to tune up your skills, perhaps. More of you, perhaps, would like to get into the business of IT. IT Pro TV is the best resource out there for learning the skills you need. They have a huge episode library, and it grows by about 50 hours a week, and I'll tell you how they do that in a second. But look what they cover: Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, A+, CCNA, Security Plus, MCSA, CISSP, Network Security, Desktop Support for Windows, for OS X, for Linux, and servers. They've got the Certified Ethical Hacker courses. That's a great cert. I'd love to get that. Hacking Forensics Investigator, Cryptography. The Virtual Machine Sandbox Lab lets you use any HTML5 browser to set up, configure, practice, and play with a Windows server and clients. And if it goes wrong, no problem. Shut the window. You don't even need a Windows machine. I've done that many a time. Measure Up practice exams included with your subscription. Those are worth $79. So if you are prepping for the test, you can practice before you take it. Now, here's how they make so many new shows. They have built two studios. They stream live at itpro.tv. In fact, there's a basic subscription that lets you watch their live stream for free. This week, they're doing CompTIA's A+ and the MCSA for Windows 10. Their live stream starts at 9:30 a.m. every Wednesday. I'm sorry, every weekday. That's 9:30 a.m. Eastern time. Next, let's see. Oh, wait a minute. This is coming up tomorrow. They're going to start their stream from the Spiceworks 2015 Spice World IT Conference. That's in Austin. Starts tomorrow through Friday. Tim and Don will be there. Say hi if you see him roaming the floor, if you're at the event. Wouldn't you like to just get access to all of this? Well, as I said, it's free with the basic account just to watch the live stuff. But if you want to peruse the library, and it is a great library with great courses, they're fun, they're engaging. These guys are funny. The live stuff, there's a chat room just like ours. There's a chat room going on. You can participate with them, ask questions. They have Q&A sessions to like study topics. So it's like your very own study group. Normally, it's $57 a month. I think that's actually a great price. $570 you buy a year. And you get it all for that price, including if you buy the year plan, you can download stuff and watch offline. You know what? They're geeks, and they understand that you're going to want to do that. And they said, well, how do we do this without getting pirated? And they said, you know what? Buy a year plan. You can do it. I think that's fair. I think that's awesome. Harvard uses IT Pro TV. MIT, UCSD, Stanford, they've got corporate and group pricing. So if you've got a company and you'd like to get your IT or a whole department, you'd like to get them up to speed, this would be great. But I got a special deal. 7-day trial. Of course I do. Wouldn't come to you without a special deal. And 30% off your subscription forever when you use the offer code SN30. That makes it less than $40 a month or $3.99 for the year. That is a very good deal, a lot less than going to a tech school would be. And I think it's a lot better, a lot more fun. You can watch on the Roku, on your computer, on your tablet, all over. They've got a great iOS and Roku apps, the brand new ones. Which allow you to keep track of where you are and jump from one app to the other, which is really cool. Daily updates, new features monthly, a very simple no-hassle cancellation policy. They're geeks. They know. They're one of us. itpro.tv/security now and use the code SN30 to try it free for 7 days and get 30% off. And do not forget, the basic plan allows accessing the live stuff. Starts at 9:30 a.m. Eastern every weekday, and tomorrow it's Spiceworks, the IT conference, Spiceworks 2015. You gotta watch then, or if you're at Spiceworks, look for Tim and Don, the folks behind itpro.tv. Go to itpro.tv/security now. We'll review. Time for a review. itpro.tv/security now. That's the website. To find out more, there's lots of free stuff. You can check it out. And if you decide to buy, 30% off and a free 7-day trial, and that discount applies for the rest of your subscription forever when you use the offer code SN30. We love them. I think you will too. itpro.tv/security now. All right. I am all ears for this because with my iPad mini, I turned on content blocking, and it really does make a big difference. But I just bought the first one I saw, which was Crystal. So I'm right. Very interested in what the differences are and so forth.
Yeah, and in fact, Crystal is the only one that I don't recommend.
Oh.
Although, well, only because there is no whitelisting feature.
Right.
And I think it's
too
entirely
simple.
Right. But and again, this is the first week, so
right.
It'd be trivial to add that. So I don't want to blackball it just because it doesn't have that. But I think it is entirely foreseeable that we're going to enter a phase where we as browser users, browsing sites, are confronted with a choice. The site says, we're ad-supported. You're blocking our ads. Therefore, we're blocking you. Some sites may just say, hey, you know, we're supported, so please consider lowering your shields so that you can, you know, your presence here can support us, because that's what makes this go. Others may just say, you're not getting in. You know, basically the equivalent of the paywall, but in this case, an ad wall. So what that says is that we need to be able to whitelist. Now, remember, though, that anytime there's a problem with looking at a site in iOS, you can hold down the little refresh curly Q, the little refresh arrow, and up pops a pop-up that allows you to reload the page without filtering. So it doesn't make it sticky and like whitelist the site for future visits, but it just says, if you want to, you can view this page with any content filtering which you may have in place disabled just for now. So that's you know, that's a workaround for not being able to whitelist. My sense is, for example, you know, sites that you want to support, like iMore, you're probably more likely to say, yeah, I want to put them on my whitelist so that I can support them. Anyway, so that's one of the criteria. Interestingly, Crystal was the only one among those that I looked at that did not offer that feature. Anyway, we'll come back to this. You might want to look at lifehacker.com, Leo. Halfway down the page is an article, the iOS ad blockers that speed up your browsing most. So you can bring that up in a minute. And I went to lifehacker.com to the homepage about halfway down. If you pull the scroll bar down halfway, you'll find the link to that page. And there's a chart there that shows the result of their benchmarks. In the meantime, our friend Dave Weiner, who we talked about a couple weeks ago. Yep, you found it. And this is not Dave Weiner, although Dave does tend to whine a little bit. Of course, he's the father of computer-based outlining that I'm a disciple of. I love outlining for organizing things. And as I understand it, Dave invented blogging, right? He was the father of...
Yeah, I don't know if invented blogging, but he created the RSS feed.
He also
is in some ways the father of podcasting because he was the one who extended RSS feeds to include binary attachments, and without which you have no podcasts. So
no podcast.
Dave is definitely a guy. He's the guy. I mean, yeah. I think his outliner, did he do Think Tank? I know he did more. A little later on.
Oh, I think Think Tank
was the one.
Yep.
And more was his.
I used Think Tank on an Apple II.
Yeah.
Back then, yeah. And was happy when it made it over to Windows.
And as I mentioned last time, he has an online outliner you can use for free.
Yes.
He's cranky, as we all are.
Yep.
He's seen a lot, but I love him. He's great.
Okay, so to put this in context, this was a blog, his blog on scripting news. It's scripting.com. So you get it. If he's got scripting.com, he's been around for a while. And he posted this on September 19th. So that was Saturday. So iOS 9 hit on Wednesday. So this is what, 3 or 4 days into, you know, ad blockalypse, that Dave writes what I'm going to share. And the reason I want to do this is what led me to a question that I hadn't thought to ask before. So he wrote, I think of advertising as, in quotes, unwanted commercial messages. He says, the unwanted part is key. I do a lot of seeking of commercial information using the web. We all do, all the time. That's how business works on the web. It seems to me that news orgs have to figure out how to make people come to their sites seeking commercial information. They're in the information gathering business, after all. Let some of the information you seek pertain to me spending money wisely or in fun or gratifying ways. What if I could go to my local paper to buy a house? I'm always interested in buying real estate, Dave writes. If they sold me a house, then they would make money from the sale. A lot more than a few cents they make off me every year for the ads I ignore, he writes. Maybe not a house. How about internet connectivity or a movie date? Someone interesting to go to a baseball game with. These are things I pay money for. I pay a lot of money to go to games. How much I enjoy it is directly proportional to who I go with. All these things involve connecting people with people. So much money to be made there. Why doesn't the news industry help me meet interesting people? Maybe that's why Facebook makes so much money. Just saying. I'm also always in the market for better internet connectivity. Could the New York Times help me there? We all live in the same city. They help me find good restaurants. Maybe if they help me find better internet. Or if they can't because it doesn't exist, if they helped to bring us better internet by constantly beating the drum for it, which is something they can do and seem to like doing, that would be worth paying for. beat the drum for new commerce and then make it possible to buy the thing through your site. He finishes, there are honest ways to make huge money on the internet. I think the message you're getting from your readers is that advertising is dishonest. The ads you show us are net are junk, jokes, sad. Please stop this. Maybe the more distilled message is this. Stop talking so much. Listen. So that's Dave, posted a few days into this whole ad blocking business. And I read that and I had this question, which I've never seen, at least in this context, asked before, which is, how much stuff should there be on the internet? That is, you know, how big should the internet be?
As big as it doesn't, there's no constraint on it.
Well, how many people should it be able to support? What I'm getting at is that because of this advertising model, which basically is about creating pages that seem more and more to be for the purpose of being viewed rather than like having a real reason to exist. What's happened is, in fact, I think I was at Recode the other day, and for some reason, all of the links were interesting. And I found myself thinking, wow, when have I ever found like a lot of stuff at a site useful or interesting? Generally, I use Google as my, you know, the index, and I go somewhere for a particular purpose, for one thing. I, you know, ignore the ads. I read what I'm there for, and then I hit back in order to, you know, check out the next finding that Google had for whatever it is I was looking for. So I guess my point is that the internet has become full of junk. There's just a bunch of crap on the internet, and we've all
Steve. One man's crap is another man's treasure. You found Recode useful. I guarantee you there are lots of people who have said there was not one link there I found useful. The internet could be as multivariate as there are people. And I don't know if you'd get a general definition of crap. In fact, at this point, the only thing everybody agrees on is that ads are crap. But
so wouldn't the prevalence of advertising tend to inflate the number of pages on the net for their own sake? Well, we've talked about, for example, how sites are now breaking articles up and making you go to successive pages.
That's a perfect example of your premise, yeah.
Yeah, so it seems to me that, you know, I mean, we're going to go through some sort of an upheaval. Dave is sort of questioning other models, essentially, because we've had advertising and because it's been the classic no-brainer. You create pages, you put ads on the pages, you generate. Now, yes, the more popular your pages are, the more popular your site is, the more traffic you will get. And so the revenue you generate from the ads on the pages increases. So if you bring more people to your site in this contest for eyeballs, then you're going to get a bigger share.
You're reinventing from first principles something that's already happened and died, which was called demand media. So somebody said, gosh, you know, really the best way to make money on the internet would be to figure out what people are searching for, create short, heavily advertised laden pages that answer that specific query. And demand media was born. And so, for instance, there'd be a page on rattlesnake belt buckles with fairly mediocre or in some cases terrible content, because one thing you don't want to do is spend money on this content. You want to generate a lot of it because you have to cover everything. What you do is you look at what the big what searches are going on, and then you create a page and you load that page with ads. And everybody thought this was going to be the next big thing.
Gosh,
it died.
Awful.
Well, it died
It deserved to die
for a couple of reasons. One, because Google deprecated it.
So Google has in its PageRank really a way of measuring quality. And, you know, kind of an automated way of measuring quality.
Well, remember the inbound links model was the thing that originally made them famous. Who's going to link to that nonsense page?
So what Google did is they started noticing what's a demand media page, and they just lowered it in the search results, and that effectively put those companies out of business. So we've gone through this cycle. Hmm. But I think that what that points out is that there is a kind of a natural push towards better content. Just doing what you suggest doesn't actually work because it's been tried.
I didn't mean to be suggesting something.
You're saying there's a natural tendency, the way the internet is constructed, to create this kind of motion towards just, you know, the content doesn't matter. Get the ad views. Make as much money as you can. And in fact, it turns out, thanks probably to the intervention of Google, but it turns out that, yes, one would think that, but in fact, there was a counter to that. And I think that the true counter is that how many people saw those pages? It only made sense if you paid nothing, like literally a buck for somebody to write that page.
Right.
And so there were – but nobody really saw that – And if Google starts to deprecate it and the pages don't show up in search, then it doesn't work.
Well, and in fact, we've also seen that on retired domain names. Domain names expire and people grab them and put crap
link farms
on them.
Yeah.
Only because there will still be traffic going to, you know, recently retired domains from inbound links that don't know any
better.
So
we owe a real debt of gratitude to our hero, Matt Cutts, who was the guy, you know, led the team at Google that did this. That basically tried to increase the, you know, make PageRank work as it should, which is you get a higher ranking based on quality of content. That's the natural way that PageRank would work.
Once again, you're a good example of doing it the right way. Twit.tv exists as a domain and site for your enterprise, much like grc.com. You know, it exists as a container for all the stuff I've done. So many other sites they're nice, but they're and the point was made, maybe it was yesterday on Twit, that, you know, a lot of sites just sort of they're here, but, you know, if users had any pushback, they would just go somewhere else. It's like, okay, I'm not going to unblock my ad blocker. I'm just going to hit back and choose another link.
Well, then it's up to Google not to even make that link show up, right? I guess it comes down to how you get to a site. And if Google search results favor better content, which I think they are trying to do, I mean, you might have bad opinion of Google and think of other things that it might be trying
to do. No, they're my search engine.
That's why we use them, right?
They find what I want.
They'd be out of business if they didn't do a good job of surfacing the best content on any given search. That's their job. And so I think that that's kind of handled. But the fact remains, there's stuff on the internet that you, Steve Gibson, are not interested in, but it's not Steve Gibson's internet. It's everybody's internet. And,
So I guess my point is that something is supporting. I know where we're kind of coming at odds. I'm suggesting that there's a lot of stuff that doesn't deserve to be on the net, which is only there because of ads. But if Google is doing its job, then no one would even know about those sites, and they wouldn't be generating any revenue no matter what ads they had, because no one would ever go there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think I come in from a different angle. I think sites should respect their community, respect their readers.
Yes.
Respect their listeners, respect their viewers.
And yes.
That's what we do. And I think our success stems 100% from the constant
Are we respecting our audience? Are we building our community? Are we doing what
and
our community
wants? And you look at the feedback. I know you look at the feedback and are constantly tuning it in order to, you know, respecting your audience is listening to what feedback they offer and say, oh, you know, hey, there's a good idea. Right. Let's do that.
And by pushing back against advertisers who want to do otherwise. But we're lucky because right. I'm in the position where I do say no to advertisers. Now, maybe I'm reducing the amount of money I make. I mean, I think of Rene Ritchie, who works for a company called Mobile Nations. His site and some of the other Mobile Nations sites have a lot of ads. One of the Mobile Nations sites, Android, I think it's Android Central, I can't use on mobile. It just doesn't work on mobile because it's crapped up. Is that in their interest? I don't think so.
No, I just again, you know, my term is perverse incentives, where if you put more advertising for a while, you get more revenue.
I understand.
And then the links begin to evaporate.
I guess that's my point, is that the incentives really aren't perverse. I think that they're, if Google does this right job. The problem is clickbait. What, it's a game, right? So they come up with new ways to trick Google. A lot of this is gaming Google.
Right, the whole SEO evolution.
And so I feel bad in some ways for people like Matt because it's a full-time job to get around these games. Look what they did to Dig. Same thing happened to Dig.
Right.
You think of Dig as a website designed to surface good content based on user votes, brilliant idea, went under because these crap websites gamed it and they couldn't figure out a way to stop it.
Yeah,
that's where you got a problem.
So I already mentioned FireEye's detection. It was on the Forbes website from September 8th through September 15th. The Forbes.com website was serving content from a third-party advertising service that had been manipulated to redirect viewers to the Neutrino and Angler exploit kits. The FireEye guys notified Forbes, who worked quickly to correct the issue. And I thought it was interesting, you know, the URLs where these ads were seen on the Forbes site. So it was Forbes.com. There was one, sabbatical leave work leadership careers advice. Should the FDA require CV outcome studies for diabetes drugs before approval? I'm sure CV was cardiovascular outcome. Then under business was the world's 100 highest paid athletes. Under investing was the Grateful Graduates Index 2015, the top 50 ROI colleges. So, of course, that's return on your investment for the cost of your education. And then under lists on Forbes was the richest person in every state. So those pages, if you were unlucky enough to go September 8th through the 15th.
That's link bait, man.
Talk about the quality of the content. And you had a browser that was like standard configuration that was missing some updates. It redirected the browser through a chain of domains, as we've talked about before, and running 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I just counted them, 7 different exploits contained in one flash file. I have the link in the show notes to their explanation that shows the JavaScript, which is a simple little piece of JavaScript, which is running a standard Flash movie and downloads it and tries to get into your system. So they conclude saying malvertising continues to be an attack vector of choice for criminals making use of exploit kits by abusing ad platforms, particularly ad platforms that enable real-time bidding, which we've covered before here. They say attackers can selectively target where the malicious content gets displayed. When these ads are served by mainstream websites like Forbes.com, the potential for mass infection becomes infection increases significantly, leaving users and enterprises at risk. So I looked at Crystal Purify, which his full name is Purify Blocker, one called Blocker without an E, B-L-O-C-K-R, Peace, which was Marco's and has subsequently been withdrawn. So it's only of interest if you happen to have it, you happen to buy it for $3 and didn't get your refund and still have it. Something called Silentium and One Blocker. And as I mentioned before, my favorite for I sort of came up with basically three. One, you know, sort of mama bear, papa bear, and baby bear. For the simplest to use, you know, not getting in your way, trivial one, essentially, is Chris Ajudis. He's the guy who took over the uBlock project. And of course, as we know, then that got forked to uBlock Origin. So I like Purify for its simplicity. It's $4, which is it's the highest priced of any of them, although the Power Tool one is $3. So they're all in that, you know, as I said, $1 to $4. And I don't think that's ought to be a big hurdle. If you're if you've found the right one and you're using it and it's saving you bandwidth and speeding up your page loads, then a couple dollars is probably not a big deal. It offers the very super simple whitelisting. One of the tricks that they've all adopted is of using their little, essentially sort of a property page where you're looking at a page and Safari has that little, you know, send this page somewhere. You're able to, and that pulls up a second dialogue. You're able to go to the three dots at the end and then turn on, you'll see the name of the privacy blocker. Turn that on, allowing it to display there. And in fact, you're able to like drag it up to the front of the list if you wanted, so it'll be immediately there when you click on the, you know, send this page somewhere. Tapping that icon for the blocker brings up its little settings sheet, which is where they typically put their whitelisting. So again, if you just want to see the page you're on with no blocking, as I mentioned, you can hold down the refresh button until a menu pops up and reload the page without any content filtering. Or if you want to whitelist the site from then and forever, then you would tap this, send this page somewhere, and then get to the controls for that privacy utility and just say, I want to enable whitelisting. So Purify was my choice for the simplest one. It offers basically he's just taking all the responsibility for blocking stuff using the lists that uBlock use, and which is a sort of the same ones that uBlock Origin uses. So it's you know, sort of from the same family and a nice simple blocker. At the complete other end of the spectrum, the Power User Blocker, also in the Lifehacker benchmark, was the fastest of all of them, is called One Blocker, the numeral one, BLOCKER. And although you don't have to drill down, you really can. In the configuration of it, you have 2,922 ad block rules, and you can individually see them. You can search them. You can put in double click. You can put in Google. So you can search these block lists. Nearly 4,000, 3,993 tracker blocking rules. You can block Twitter widgets with 7 rules, Facebook widgets with 9 rules, 18 other share widgets, web fonts, Discus comments, or adult sites. And in every case, you're able to granularly select which of those as a class or individual rules. You can also go to my.oneblocker.com, which takes you to a beautiful web-based rule creator where you're able to design your own rules and rule categories. And then he has a way of allowing you to import them into one blocker. It's free to download, so there's no charge to get it. But you can only enable one class of blocking. And everyone's going to want to turn on ad blocking and tracker blocking and maybe Twitter and Facebook and share widgets and things. So immediately you get hit with, I want $3. But again, $3 for this, if you really want a power user's content filtering tool, this is the one blocker. And we see from Lifehacker's benchmark of about 15, it was way ahead. I mean, substantially faster in their testing of 8 different sites where they did URLs and measured the speed, the best speed improvement of all. And for the in-between one, it's the least expensive, just $1. It's sort of the compromise between those two, is Blocker with no E, B-L-O-C-K-R. It does offer a pop-up whitelist, which I think any workable blocker is going to need. And then you can choose when you pop up what you want to change. It will allow you some, so you have granularity, which is, for example, missing from Purify, the super simple one. This one, so for only $1, you can choose ads, media, privacy, social buttons, and cookies. And so you can add exceptions for any site in a whitelist, and also determine whether you want those blocked or not by default. So that's the take. I'm sure we're going to, in fact, Lifehacker found a bunch more than I have found here. These are the first ones that I saw came out. If anything significant happens in the category, we will keep an eye out for it. And of course, I'll let you know. But for now, I think on the low end, Purify; on the high end, one blocker. For those, you pay either $3 or $4. Or if you want something simple but some control, some granularity, then it's Blocker, B-L-O-C-K-R, for $1.
Turns out that so one of the reasons Marco pulled out is because his Blocker piece blocked the ads that were on his site, as well as his friend John Gruber's Daring Fireball site.
Yes.
And there was no easy way. I mean, he didn't want to modify the Ghostery database. He thought that would be unfair.
So his ads were in the Ghostery database.
Yeah.
Right.
And they shouldn't be. And this is the real problem I have with ad blockers. They're really a blunt sword.
Yes.
Because the ads on Marco's site and Gruber's site and Jim Dalrymple's The Loop are very unobtrusive. They're from a server called The Deck. They don't have Flash. They're aimed at Mac users because those all three are Mac-focused sites. They're as good as an ad can be. They look like a first-party ad. And they don't track. They're blocked by everyone, including, by the way, one blocker.
I was going to say, the good news, though, is...
You could modify
With one blocker, you could just put a couple characters of the domain name in. It will find the rule for you, and there's a simple switch for turning it off.
Yeah, in this...
I know. I mean...
Let me show you the URL filter that you have to add. It's basically grep. It's regular expression. I have to say that's not going to happen. Nobody's going to do that. And that's the real problem with these blockers, is you're punishing everybody who has ads of any kind. And it's really the small custom sites run by one or two people, like the ones we just mentioned, that are going to suffer the most.
I think as we've said, this is a move to another model. And so this is the users of the internet saying, this got out of control. We're saying no. And in a sense, it's an overreaction. It is blunt, and it unfortunately hurts the good ads as much as the really obnoxious ones.
The responsible advertisers and sites that respect their users. I'm just glad that Twit is not a blog, is not a web-based enterprise, because we'd be out of business.
Yeah,
and really sad. I completely understand.
completely understand the very legitimate reasons for doing it. I wish there were a tool. Maybe that's what AdBlock was trying to do with their, what was it, approved ads system.
Well, and you heard that they contacted the various iOS blockers and tried to sell them on permitting.
That's not what people want.
No.
People don't want ads anymore. But what they don't understand is Seth Godin says, this is a 100-year-old model, free ad-supported media that trades content for your attention. And you're breaking it. It's not the user's fault. I understand it's probably the advertisers who broke it. But you're going to lose a lot of great stuff. I'm sad. And what you're going to get is the sites that get around it. The crap stuff is going to, this is going to increase crap, not decrease it. I bet you. But we'll see. In a few years, we'll know. And I'm just glad I didn't do a blog.
It's funny because a couple of years ago, Mark Thompson was saying, Gibson, you don't have any ads on your site. You know, it looks kind of strange not to have ads on your site.
Ads
are supposed to have ads. And I said, I'll get around to it someday. Yeah. Now I don't think so.
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
No.
You have a better model. You sell SpinRite, world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility, grc.com. Just go there. You buy it. That supports Steve. There's lots of free stuff there. Really, that's one of the things that's great about that site is all the free stuff, including a feedback form if you want to ask questions for next week. grc.com/feedback. He's got 16 kilobit ad-free versions of the show over there as well. If you can stand the low quality, you won't hear any ads. That's the upside. He also has 64 kilobit audio and full transcriptions, which is great. And we really appreciate you doing that. We have the rest. We have the high quality. Everything we have has ads in it. I'm sorry. 64 kilobit versions of the audio, as well as three different versions of video at twit.tv/SN. You'll also find us in most of the podcast application. In fact, I don't think there's anything that doesn't have security now. Find it and subscribe, and that way you won't miss an episode. You think Q&A next week?
Yep, let's go for a Q&A next week.
Right.
So send your questions in. I will go through them. I did go through them for this week because this was nominally supposed to be Q&A. Everybody was wanting to talk about ads and ad blocking. So I thought, we'll talk about
it. No, I'm really glad you did. Yeah, I'm really glad you did. It's very timely. All right, Steve, we'll see you next time on Security Now. Bye-bye.
Thanks, buddy. Security Now.